So, quick announcement before we get into the show today. I want to tell you that at the beginning of February, the show is going behind a paywall. To listen to the shows, I'm going to ask you to join the Smaller Fish Extended Panel. For €5 plus VAT a month, you'll get exclusive access to 16 shows guaranteed. You've over 17 hours entertainment guaranteed for the price of a pint. Benetti Menswear was a short-term sponsorship deal. It's not easy to get brands to take on a new show for a year, and I don't have any sales team to be dealing with it, you know, month on month. Big brands that could afford yearly sponsorship, that can be very hard to deal with. They worry about things that I don't worry about, like political correctness, gender balance, you know, amongst the pundits. I don't feel I would be in control of my own show, and that's not what I want. And I don't think it's what you guys listening want either. So I'm asking all of you to be my bosses. The show is going to be led by you, the subscribers. That means no ads whatsoever on the show. I felt my old show, the GER, was going to go behind a paywall. The show hadn't been sponsored in 2 years, and I had a meeting with the new bosses about the subscriber model. And my thinking was that GEA people might be more inclined to give me their fiver, another GEA man, you know, trying to do it on my own independently of any media, than to give it to a big media company. So starting in February, we're going to be members of the Smaller Fish Extended Panel. You'll have to go on patreon.com or download the Patreon app at the end of the month and search for Smaller Fish. So along with the 16 shows, you get priority notice to live shows and exclusive entry to our end of year AGM, where you can meet the team. I'll even buy you a pint. That's one of your months back, one of your fivers plus VAT back. So that's it. We're going to have a very big extended panel next year. I don't want to see any faces in any of you, because you're all going to see Game Time throughout the year.
Smaller Fish Holding Show, huh? I wouldn't listen to that gutless show if you paid. That's wrong.
These bluffers know as much about top-level hurling as I do about the sleeping habits of the Ayatollah.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are, and we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Welcome along to Smaller Fish GAA. We're in association with Benetti Menswear. Featured stock list can be found online at benetti.ie. So this is the last of our new shows here on Smaller Fish. I wanted to introduce them all in January. All the pundits will have been introduced, except for Ollie Baker and Conal Keeney. They're going to be on next Thursday's show for the league preview. This one's called Hurling and Farming with Damien Hayes. So there's only one person I can introduce for this show, Damien, and that's you.
Yeah, hi Colm, how are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. We're moving on to Smaller Fish here, Damien. You've been with me since the very start. You've been with me 5.5 years now. The very first hurling show ever with JJ Delaney, you're on the go since.
Yeah. It's hard to believe when you said it was 5.5 years, Colm. So we've had no major rows on us since. So we'll keep it going. So I know it. Look, it's something I enjoy doing is talking a little bit of hurling. I don't like to my own self, I don't like to blackguard anyone or knock someone or you know, run them down or whatever. So so I enjoy doing it. So thanks again, Colm.
No problem at all. So to see the news that's breaking there now as we speak, you might not be have seen it because you're busy selling cars, that the water breaks are gone. So they're finished with. There's no more quarters, Damien. I, for one, am delighted with this.
Yeah, it used to annoy me because a water break could often make you or break you, you know, and you could be hurling for as well. And next thing you get a water break, and when the lads go back out, it would you know, the game would have turned another way or whatever, but I just didn't see the meaning for it. And number two, the water breaks didn't turn out to be water breaks. It turned out to be like a basketball timeout tactic session. And my opinion on the whole water break was it was meant to be 60 seconds that you often turn into 3 minutes.
And yes.
I'm absolutely delighted with that bit of team news.
Do you think that some players, though, will have gotten used to that minute or two break in the middle of a half? Like, I mean, you know, will it take a bit of getting used to going straight through?
No, it'll take nothing to get used to it. Lads will just go back to normality and go back hurling 30, 35 minutes aside and get on with it. So it was a pure nuisance, if I was to be very honest. Like, there'll be some players that would nearly be waiting for the water break. So now they have no excuses to get into it from the start. But I suppose just for me that had done a bit of coaching in the last two previous years, it was annoying, if I was to be very honest, because like the bit of feedback that you were giving the players, I know, is it at the break, I don't think anyone was really listening, any of us. You know, lads were drinking and just running back out again. So I didn't see the point of it, and I'm delighted it's gone.
Yeah. You wonder how much attention some players, you know, pay even to the halftime speech, because a lot of the times the gym manager saying kind of generic stuff, you're kind of sitting there thinking of your own performance. You know, there's a lot of things going through your head that a lot of that stuff isn't necessarily sinking in unless they change your position or something. That obviously applies to you.
Yeah, well, my opinion on it, Colm, is that there's some players out there that they don't want feedback, they don't take feedback, they don't take it well. There's some players that have been moping around the dressing room. You know, this is at halftime. Other players are going into the toilet. There's other lads there that are absolutely tuned into no level, that they're watching every piece of your lip movement, your eyes, everything. So yeah. everyone is different. But I would agree with that. There's some players, it wouldn't matter what you were saying to them in the dressing room, I often wonder, do they be listening at all? Because when they go out in the second half, they could be doing the same thing that they were at in the first half, and they haven't taken any heed to what you're saying. So, I often wonder the same thing. Do lads listen, you know?
Yeah, maybe not. The Mair Fuarnas are back. So obviously Brian Lohan was talking at the weekend about the water breaks, and if they go, how are we going to get instructions on? And John Kiley was talking about the same thing. We can't get instructions on. And I do take their point, because the Mair Fuarna was done away with after the water breaks. Now the water breaks are gone. At least the Mair Fuarna is back in. But one change they've made to it, Damien, is that managers, coaches, substitutes, injured players, or members of the extended panel may not be the Mair Fuarnas. So I don't know, you suppose you'd have to go fishing outside your group to do that. And then is the Mair Fuarnas in your dressing room, but he's not part of your group? You know, it's a bit of a, it's nonsense.
Like, what difference does it make whether your Mair Fuarnas is one of your selectors and he's running across the pitch giving water and telling your centre back after next piece of play, you're going wing back. You're going marking him, he's causing us problems. I just don't. Sometimes I just don't see the reasoning behind some of these decisions and rules. And like, as I do say, like, what major difference? Once he doesn't upset the game, and he's
well, you see, that's the thing. I think that's what they think, that someone on the backroom team or the injured player would be too emotionally involved in a game and might get caught up in a skirmish that's going on inside the field, maybe, or something.
Yeah, well, that's where if it came down to good business play, that's where they come into getting fined.
Maybe just like players, Damien, if you get involved in something like that, then you're not the water. You're suspended from being a water carrier. I suppose that works on the playing field.
Well, if anything happens with a water boy, lads, and he's your selector or he's your sub goalkeeper, he obviously has to wear the proper the bibs, whatever. But if an issue happens like this, it's an automatic €15,000 fine to your county board. It's in black and white. Just for example, once it's in black and white, I don't have issues with certain things, you know, and that's my own opinion on it. But I don't think it should make much deal whether it's a sub goalie or whatever. Once he doesn't disrupt the game or cause problems or axe the mick, I don't have an issue with it.
Yeah, they'd have to be fit anyway, because they need to get in and get out very, very, very quickly. So, yeah, you know, kind of
for Liam Sheedy, it used to be Tommy Dunn. Used to be, he's like, you know, the what we call the runner. They used to go around, like, and Tommy Dunn, I'd say, is unbelievably fit for his age, because you'd see him up one end of the field and down the far end of the field, you know. But so, yeah, you'd want to be able to do a couple of 5Ks, all right.
What did you make of TJ at the weekend? He's man, isn't he?
I think he's incredible. Genuinely, like, you know, we often speak, like, we in our house, we talk about hurling and, like, like, you know, people often, you know, when they speak about Kilkenny, the first go-to line is, like, you know, Henry Shefflin. You know, I think TJ is better than Henry. You know, I mean it, because Henry played with way better players than TJ. And, like, TJ, for me, is doing it day in, day out. You know, I'm giving him huge praise here, but I just think the man is unbelievable. Wins his own ball, scores from play, he's able to score frees. He's able to get stuck into the middle of it. He's able to win his own 50-50 ball. He's no problem running back into a ruck and hooking the ladder or getting stuck in. And he's able to score pressure, penalties and frees when it comes to it. And I just think the man, you know, pound for pound, I think the man is absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, there's nothing he's not good at, I suppose, really.
You know,
like, I mean,
and he's a ball winner and he's a leader. Like, you know, and like when it came to the last 15 minutes of that game against St. Thomas's Thursday, like, he was the go-to man, but like, the management put him straight in full forward to see, you know, could he work something? You know,
and, yeah.
I just think, I personally just think TJ is brilliant. And I just think his work rate is incredible. And the one thing I love about him is he's not just a free taker. I've often said this in your podcast that I see a lot of free takers going around just taking frees and taking line balls and stuff like this and not getting into the play as much. But TJ gets into it straight away and he's taking frees and he's taking line balls and he's scoring from play and he's scoring goals. To me, I just think he's brilliant.
This Ballyhill versus Ballygunner has the makings of a sensational game. Like, I'm thinking back, like, I mean, it has a lot of similarities to 2010 when Ballyhill beat you guys. You were going for three in a row. It's never been done at club hurling level. Bally, you know, ye had beaten Ballyhill the year before in the semi-final. They came back, stopped you for three in a row. Ballyhill beat Ballygunner 2 years ago in the semi-final, and now Ballygunner are going to try and stop them for the three in a row. So I suppose, like, there are comparisons.
Audrey, and as you said, it has all the mix of going to be an absolutely brilliant final. And to be fair, the Ballyhill St. Thomas's game was a great game as well the other day. It has the makings of a real good game. Ballygunner have been there for a long, long time. They've had a group of players. They're good enough to win a club on Ireland. Whether they can see it out is another thing. Ballyhale haven't been playing well all year. They're just about stumbling across the line, right? But Colin, you're going to laugh when I'm going to say it to you here. I remember something similar happened to Portumna. We played Ardrahan, so we did, in a county quarter final, and we won the game by a point. And we probably shouldn't have won the game given Ardrahan their, you know, giving them their praise that they probably should have beaten us. But we just scraped over it. I got a last second point the same day myself to win it. But it absolutely galvanized us. And right. I have this fear that Ballyhale will know they got out of jail the other day. There will be a lot of wake up calls for lads. There'll probably be a lot of home truths. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if I seen Ballyhale putting in an unbelievable performance in the Club on Ireland final day. It just reminded me so much that when we bet Ardrahan, we went on and won the Club All Ireland that year, beating Mount Leinster Rangers, and we never looked back. So it's going to be the makings of a great final, and I hope it is. I really hope it is going to be a mighty final.
But Ballygunner will have all the hunger, I suppose. In that final 2010, Ballyhale, they were 6 points up after 15 minutes against you lads. So, like, I mean, how do you keep going? That's 3 years in a row. It's never been done. And it's the longest championship to win. Getting through your club, or getting through your county, getting through your province, getting through the semi-final, back to the final for 3 years.
Yeah, I know. And you can nearly see it in the Ballyhale players. They're a little bit sluggish. They're not, we'll say, getting to the breaking ball as quick as they would like, but that's where Ballygunner have to really bring their hunger to their game, you know. And like, they're very fit, and they play a lovely brand of hurling. It's short pass and it's stick pass, and they've got some lovely players on it, big family names as well with Ballygunner. But that's where Ballygunner have to, if they want to win it, they have to really show their hunger to see this one home. And I would love to see it. I'd go on record here saying I'd love to see Ballygunner winning the Club All Ireland, and I'd possibly be shouting for them because I always love the underdog, you know, when he's playing in the final. But Ballygunner to win this All-Ireland, they'll have to bring the hunger to it and see out the game.
Did you know there's only 20 minutes between the two clubs? I never knew that. And even more, did you know that the Reeds are related to the Mahonies?
Oh, jeez. this is like the Kellys are related to the Mourns. The Kellys from Tip Mulnahone and the Mourns from Tip. So I didn't know. I knew that Ballygunner and Ballyhale was very close. Probably most of them went to Water IT in college. They probably all know each other. And they've probably played each other rake times and challenge matches, I bet you. But I didn't know that there was a relations. But I just hope that it will be a great game of hurling.
Yeah, no, I think it will. It's a classic. And I'm kind of siding, I love Ballyhale Shamrocks, but I'm kind of siding for Ballygunner in that as well. You have to give Thomas's their due. They did Galway Hurling proud, Damien. Like, what are you like as a proud Portumna man? Do you row in behind the county champions?
Once the team from Galway comes out of Galway, of course you'll be shouting for them. Like, there's no point. Like, we would have had our rivalry with St. Thomas's, so we did. I think they won a Club All Ireland in 2013, and then we played them, would you believe, three times the following year. We played them in the group stages and we beat them. Then we played them in the county semi-final and we drew with them, and then we beat them in the county semi-final. So we did, and I think for the first semi-final we played them in Athenry that particular year. Over 10,000 people turned up to that game in Kinney Park in Athenry.
Jeez.
So, but like St. Thomas's at the time were the up and coming team. I suppose they were told that they were going to replace Portumna. We were at the end of our, I suppose, our reigns, but we put in a massive performances them year. That year, that was the year we bet. I was telling you the story that we bet Ardrahan by a last second pint.
Yeah.
And we went on and beat Mount Leinster Rangers in the final. But no, the way it works in Galway, well, the way it works with me is that when a Galway team comes out of Galway to represent the county in the All Ireland series, obviously you'd shout for them and roar them on. And to be fair, they nearly did everything right. We'll put out Jay to win the game, and they were beaten by a last stroke of magic from an absolute brilliant player. And
yeah,
you reminded me so much, Colm. Portumna, in 2002, Portumna, we were trying to make the breakthrough in 2002, and we played Sarsfields, and we were up 2 points against Sarsfields in a county semi-final in Duggan Park in Bannisloe. And didn't we give away a free on the 21? And the legendary Joe Cooney from Sarsfields, left hand on top, stood over the 21 and he absolutely roofed it. And when the ball was poked out, the game was over. We lost by a pint.
Oh,
it reminded me so much of that. And like that, it was a sickening feeling when Sarsfields beat us that day. So I can only imagine how the St. Thomas's players felt afterwards, that they would be absolutely sickened. But in fairness, they gave a great account of themselves and it was a great game of hurling and they have nothing to be ashamed of.
So you've been on the receiving end of those last puck of the game losses. Have you ever won them? I can't remember ever winning with the last kick of the game. You'd never have that luck. Look at Ballyhale. They've won they drew with Rhinas in the very last puck of the game and they've beaten Thomas's. Two out of three games into one season, they've done that. Like, I mean, you'd probably be lucky. I was saying I'm on the show, you'd be lucky to remember two times in your entire career happened to you.
I do remember two times in my own career that we played at the Tory Dardrahan one, which was that one. And then another one was we beat Port Roe, so we did, in an All-Ireland Kilmacud Sevens semi-final, where I'll never forget it. The score was 1-6 to 9 points. And Gleeson was playing goals, now the Antrim manager. And he got the ball up in Kilmacud and he sidestepped me and he ran out the field and he probably thought that I wasn't going to run after him. And he'd done a big massive swing, so he did, to drive the ball, and I blocked him down and the ball broke out and I rose the ball and I hit it over my shoulder and I put it over the bar and we won the game. And when the ref blew up the whistle, your man on the scoreboard still had it down as 1-6 to 9 points. Right? So a little bit of an argument started, but we went through, so we did, because we won 1-6 to 10 points. So they're the two.
Right, the two times. I would have thought with Joe Canning on the freeze that he would have lined up a 21-metre one and lashed it in late in the game.
Joe would often have scored goals for us to win games. But you just asked me on two particular ones. But I'm trying to think of one that Joe ever roof. It just doesn't come to call.
Right.
But one that does come to memory is the Joe Cooney one. So it is Portumna versus Sarsfields. And he stood over the ball and left hand on top. And there must have been 12 lads in the goals. And he absolutely rifled it.
Talking about Joe Canning, you weren't surprised to hear he wasn't going back in anyways. You know, he's a man.
I wasn't surprised, Colin, because actually he's an odd miles on the clock, and I know him personally, obviously with my own club, but he's odd. So the man has struggled with injuries, and as like you can say what you like, it takes a lot out on the body. So it is. So and then when I heard he went in with the Galway Miners, I knew that he wasn't going to be retiring and unretiring. Once Joe made his decision, he had made his decision. And you know something, I'd say it's probably a positive thing for Henry to know that he's definitely not coming back. So that what I mean by that is that Henry now can plan without him. It's not a case, we'll have a chat now again in March and April and we'll see how you're feeling or whatever like that. So
Joe needs more time.
Yeah, or we're giving Joe the win. You know, it leads on and Chinese whispers and the media jumping on the bandwagon. When Joe retired, I know by him he retired, and he's gone in now with the Galway Miners to do a small bit of training with Fergal Healy and Mark Kearns and the Bison. And, you know, he what I liked about it was he put it to bed that he wasn't going to be coming back, or his name being filtered around it. There's a possibility of him coming back, you know. So and look, he's retired now, and let him enjoy his retirement, and no better man to deserve it.
Yeah, were you surprised he went back in coaching, or was that something he'd like?
No, because he loves it. Like the answer is, I wasn't one bit surprised, but I suppose like he's. I think Joe is living in Galway, so I do. So like it wouldn't be an awful distance from him to go to train in Attenry or Pier Stadium or in Loch George. So no, I wasn't surprised at all. No.
Right. Right. What did you make of the Henry Shefflin news? Like, I mean, were you delighted when you heard it, or were you expecting Davy, or were you getting excited?
Should the rumor was, Colin, telling you the truth, was that the rumor was that Davy Fitz had the job got on the Monday.
Yeah.
And it was heavily rumored down here in Innes that Davy Fitz had got the job, and there's all these rumors going around that certain players drove down to Henry's house and met him, and then the county board met Henry the following day, and then on the Thursday, which Davy was meant to be ratified as the new Galway hurling manager, instead of his name being mentioned as the new manager, Henry's name was mentioned. So, of course, it was a surprise to us all, because no one mentioned Henry for the job. It was all talk about Davy Fitz. So it literally happened overnight. So it was, but I think it's a good appointment. It'll be a breath of fresh air. He can come in, pick the players that he likes, the players that he wants on merit, and go from there.
Yeah. Any names that we should keep our eye out for from those four in a row minors? Like, I mean, just as a casual fan, I don't really hear of any new kind of, you know, big names coming up in Galway hurling, you know, that we haven't seen. Is there any, you know, anything that you're excited coming?
The truth of it is, there's not, Colm, you know, and I often say this, you know, I hope the hurling talent that Henry thinks that's in Galway is there, because sometimes I do wonder, are the hurlers out there? I know we won minor All-Irelands, but that doesn't always work out, you know.
So of four minor All-Ireland winning teams, you're telling me there wouldn't be two or three exceptional players?
They're not standing out in club hurling. Sure, they're not on the teams.
Yeah.
Like, the truth of it is, like, Shane O'Neill was the manager of Galway hurlers for 2 years, and the truth of it is, a lot of the lads that were on the teams were probably the best that they had.
Yeah, and they were the ones that were there before.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so Henry has to find new players. The rumor is that there's 70 of them in their training at the moment. You know, so he'll filter them out and keep the ones that he wants. You know, but as I said, if the current batch of Galway players, I suppose, can't take something from Henry, like, as in, you know,
yeah,
like, you know what I'm saying? Like, geez, they have to start putting in performances, and the huge issue with Galway hurling is consistency. That's a huge issue.
Yeah, no, it definitely. And then Micheál Donoghue's name got back into the mix too, didn't it? And
the rumor was as well, Colm, that Liam wanted to put in a special S&C coach and stuff like this. Just and seemingly it broke down there. This is just
or Micheál did.
Yeah, Micheál. Sorry, Micheál. Yeah, apologies, Micheál. And he wanted to put in a special program and whatever to get lads up to the level of Limerick, of their body conditioning and all that. So the rumour went around in this. I suppose the county board saying it throughout weren't going to back him on this. And I suppose everything broke down. Communications broke down and he took his name out of the running again.
Right, okay, that's interesting. Did you see Wexford? They have a new manager, obviously, Darry Egan, who you'd know in Tip.
Yeah.
They have Billy Walsh in their backroom team. So Billy Walsh, who obviously is a boxing coach and set up the high-performance unit, and we got loads of goals in the Olympics and medals in the Olympics. He played with Wexford at under-21 level, which I was surprised to hear. But Dara Egan said he was home an awful lot of December, and we had him in with the players for one great morning's work. And then he was at a few training sessions where he was really good meeting with the backroom team afterwards. We're going to use them with our leadership group as the year goes along. He has serious expertise. Like, what's a leadership group, Damien?
I have no clue. It's all keywords. It's all, I don't know. It's like saying we'll get the ball into the scoring zone and we'll recycle it and all. They're all buzzwords.
transition. But here's the reason I was wondering, because we had a leadership group with Laois under Liam Cairns where he had about 7 senior players that used to meet with the management. And geez, I don't know, did you ever have that in Galway? I thought it was favouritism, and I thought I didn't like it.
Did all them 7 lads, were all them 7 on the team?
Oh yeah, there would have been the kind of teacher's pet type. I thought it created a division in the squad, like that there was a separate.
I would be the same as that. Look at Colin, I just think it's all buzzwords like this. At the end of the day, right, Darry Egan is the manager of Wexford and the best look to him, and he's after bringing all these guys into it. At the end of the day, they're going to be racers on results and on their hurling. I often say, like, sometimes a player needs a little pep talk, and sometimes a little player needs to be pulled to one side and he needs to be told straight between the two eyes what you actually think of him, what he needs to improve on. You know, and then it's called the sandwich. Like, you praise him, then you tell him what he needs to improve on, and you praise him again at the end. It's called a sandwich treatment. Like this, but like all these words, I won't lie to you. I find it's all very, very annoying. And it's like I've spoken before to you about these S&C coaches. It's all grand, these S&C coaches, and you can get as big as you want, you can get as strong as you want and all that. But at the end of the day, hurling is all about hitting the ball over the bar, winning your own ball, winning your own dirty ball. Can you, you know, is your first touch good enough? And I just think sometimes it's complicated. So what's a leadership group? I don't know. A leadership group is that you have a couple of players that come back to the management and tell them how good they are and what they need to do and make sure I'm still on the team.
I do accept Billy Walsh coming in there, because obviously he set up the high performance unit. He's coming from a very professional background.
He would be more mental.
Yeah, well, you'd hope he's not hurling coaching anyways, but I do think he said he would have a meeting with the backroom team. I think Billy Walsh might coach their setup, their backroom team, you know, how to get this fine-tune things, you know, have it running smoothly in a very professional manner. I can see the value of a Billy Walsh coming in some capacity. He's a Wexford man, a proud Wexford man, and he's home or whatever. So Darry Egan, probably making a good call there. Then I'm reading the next bit of news. Gordon Darcy, another proud Wexford man, he's in under backroom team now as well. So this is Billy Walsh grand, Gordon Darcy. I'm wondering who he's going to pull out of his hat next. So Gordon Darcy, apparently, he goes with them on match days, and he watches their body language in the warm-up. So here's Darry Egan again. He says, even in-game, it's not hurling information he's giving. He's giving body language information. He's giving how the substitutes are preparing, how they're watching, how they're ready for the game. Are they focused? Like, I mean, Jesus, I don't know. Like, I mean, do you think there's a role there for an ex-professional rugby player to start feeding back to you the body language of your subs?
Colin, the truth of it is, the body language will never be all... will never be brilliant from a sub, because he could be a bit peed off that he's not on the team. And
See, you're not allowed to be like that now, Damien. They're called energy suckers or something that. That's what they're.
Some call them ragwort as well. You know, in weeds they call them. But
And that's fair.
Yeah, but also, Colin, you have to remember, and I've said this to you before, that there's some players that don't want to make the team and are happy being subs.
Yeah,
and I've said that to you before. And the other thing is, there's some management teams that are happy having a player that doesn't want to make the team and is happy being a sub, so that he's just there to make up the 15-a-side matches. And that's a fact. There's no manager that'll admit to that, but it's one less headache that he doesn't have to speak to your man, because your man is just like on setup like this.
Yeah.
But for Darcy to watch lads' body language, I don't know, Colin. I think you know my opinion on this. The manager should be able, and the management team should be able to get the feedback of the player's body language. And at the end of the day, Colin, I've spoken about this many times. If you're put on a Wexford jersey playing for your county, or an Offaly jersey, a Laois jersey, Galway, Kilkenny, Cork, Tip, like it has to mean something to you. And if it isn't coming from yourself, then there's an issue with the player.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, I was a terrible sub, Damien, and I'm not an example that I should use at all. I was on the scale where I was an energy sapper, and I was a weed, and I was a bad influence around the place if I had a face on me, etc. And when I was supposed to be doing warm ups with the subs, I'd just jog up one end, I'd pretend I'm stretching and I'd run back down, you know, and get on the bench. Now, like, I mean, that's an extreme level. I don't think the body language of someone who's a little bit pissed off at being a sub, maybe that bit of fire in his belly will drive him on to play well when he comes on.
The example there is Michael Darren McCall. I watched Laker Gale the other day, and he explained it very honestly that Jim Gavin dropped him for a game and he was really peed off over it. And he dropped Bernard Brogan as well for the same game. It was a final against Mayo. Both the players are really peed off, and the two players come on and made a huge difference because they were a bit peed off like this. So I accept exactly what you're saying, but like, you're not going to have great body language if you're a peed off player.
You can say pissed off, but I'm like Gordon Darcy's coming from a professional environment where it's his job, it's literally his profession to act professionally even when he's not on the team and be a professional. But I think applying those standards to a poor old, you know, number 24 down Wexford who might have a face on him, and now Gordon Darcy's going back telling Darry Egan, that lad now, you know, the body language there now completely off, you know. And now the young number 24 on the Wexford panel is getting, you know, given out for not being a professional when he's not a feckin' professional.
Yeah, I agree with you, Colm. And I sometimes wonder about the truth of some of them, you know, does he actually do that? Like, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense in a lot of regards, you know. So sometimes I would say a lot of it will be coming from Dara himself.
Yeah, he seems to want this anyways. I don't know. Maybe there's some value in it. I'm hoping to get Dara on the show and maybe have a chat to him about some of this stuff. It's interesting, at least, you know. I don't know. Maybe all these things, like Bernard Dunn was in with the Dublin Footballers, and I'm scratching my head at it and, you know, wondering what value is there. And sure, I suppose if it adds value to two or three players,
yes, that's
isn't it. It's all these inches, you know, all these extra things are these inches, Damien.
Yeah, and you are right. If five players get something out of it, yeah, it was worth doing it. If he gets on well with five players and these couple of players ring him to ask him something and he relays it back to the manager and he relays back to the player then that, no, this is what he meant. You know, you picked up that piece of information wrong, whatever. You know, I would see their roles, just being honest, Colm, is that they're more to do with psychology, more to do with people skills that they can relay back, or the lads can speak to them and get little snippets of information on how to improve on training or nutrition or weights or training. You know, I don't know, Colm, but like, you wouldn't be going up to Darcy, for example, and asking like, how do you improve your striking or your first touch, or how do I start getting better under the high ball?
Yeah, you talk to him about pressure on a big day and, you know, like, I mean, things going wrong for you, you know, how do you maybe, you know, deal with those situations? Yeah, look, listen, there's obviously a value. I suppose, like, everyone on the panel is different. I'd be wondering, where does this stop if you keep appeasing the two or three that's on a panel that, you know, that might like something? Like, I mean, you could end up having a backroom team of 50. Maybe we're heading that way. Come here, another one before we get into a little bit of farming for the first ever time. It's not the first ever time. We've spoken briefly about some farming, bales of straw and donkeys before, but we'll get into a little bit more in part two. The All-Stars, Damien, is you've three All-Stars, right? And one thing, because I was talking to you yesterday on the phone, that's kind of pissing you off a little bit is, you know, fellas getting All-Stars and almost running them down saying, look, this is grand, but the main thing is that we won an All-Ireland, or the main thing is that the team is improving, instead of enjoying the fact that they've won an All-Star.
Oh, absolutely. It just came up in our conversation when you rang me there yesterday just to say, you know, to give the time that we'll be going on air and getting organised. But I just, one thing that always hates me, like, you know, it really came back to our little, we have three kids at home, right? And Aina has just gone 8, and like, we watch the All Stars on TV, you know, and next thing, Aina's getting big into hurling. He loves sport in general, but he just turns around to me and he says to me, will I be an All Star, daddy? Like this. And I said to him, you know, and I just started explaining to him, Elena, it's a very hard thing to become an All Star. It takes a lot of training, a lot of commitment, everything like this. And like, I was in listening to these players being interviewed about winning an All-Star and what it was like to win. And every one of them, nearly to a man, said, oh, you know, it's grand to win an All-Star, but it's all about winning an All-Ireland like this. The truth of it is, Colm, not every player wins an All-Ireland medal. You know, you're not fortunate enough to have a team good enough to win an All-Ireland medal. And my and the greatest example that I can give to this is two of my greatest hurling heroes when I was growing up was Tony Brown and Ken McGrath. I absolutely loved them two players from Waterford to no end in the way they hurled and the commitment they showed. And they never won All-Ireland medals, but they won All-Stars. And like you're wondering, like, what's it like to win an All-Star? For me, it was incredible. It was an incredible honor, and to say that I was proud was an understatement. And I will never forget the day that I got a phone call to say that I was after winning an All-Star in 2005. Ollie Cannon got one as well the same year. I was the third club player in Portumna like this. I'll never forget the excitement in our house. You know,
yeah. Were you expecting one that year?
I was. You know what? We got to the All Ireland in 2005. So when Cork beat them, I was after coming off a brilliant club campaign as well. I was after really hurling well. I got a nominee in 2004. But like when I got it, I was absolutely thrilled. Was to say it properly, and the excitement in our house, my mother and father that brought me to matches and training sessions and trials. My brothers came up that night to the banquet, so they had no tickets, but they still got in and celebrated this All-Star like they're after winning it. But what I mean by that is, Colin, like, to win an All-Star, it's an individual award, you're right, but it's an individual award on the back of a team, playing on a team. But like I if someone asked me today what was it like winning an All-Star, I would have said straight up on the television, like, I'm absolutely delighted, I'm absolutely thrilled, this means so much to me. And it did, and I'm honored and thankful and blessed to say that I won three of them, right? And I really am. But I just hate when certain players I suppose to put the low key, because at the end of the day they truly are thrilled and honored.
Yeah, and I just don't understand why being very proud of a personal achievement is something to be ashamed of. Not ashamed of, is something that you need to run down to be seen as humble, and you need to be, you know, keep enforcing that it's all about the team. It's absolutely fantastic to win an individual award. It means, you know, you've been recognised, all your hard work has come true. Because if players, like, players dream of winning All-Irelands, there's no doubt about that. That's your first kind of dream. But winning an All-Star is very close.
Oh, it's without question. Like, you know, and the truth of it is, I remember Tommy Walsh said it in an interview that he won an All-Star, and he met Brian Cody after the banquet. And Brian Cody said to him afterwards, like, you know, it's some feeling winning an All-Star. He says, now the goal is to get back up on that podium for next year. Like, it was near, like, it's setting goals like this. And, like, you have to set goals for yourself. But as I just said, you know, when I won an All-Star in 2005 and I won another one then in 2012. So you might say, geez, Damien, you didn't win one for 7 years. But the truth of it was, I didn't win one with 7 years because Galway didn't go well in them 7 years from 2006 to 2012. Did we come close to winning an All-Ireland? The answer was no. Were we good enough to win an All-Ireland? The possibility, the answer was no, we weren't good enough. And like, the as you well know, Colm, like, is it roughly an average 12 to 13 players come off the day of the All-Ireland final is All-Stars.
Yeah.
Like, and in 2010, I won an All-Star, and if you can recall, Tip beat us by a last second point, so they did in the All-Ireland quarter-final. So we did, and I won an All-Star up to the stage of getting to a quarter-final in 2010, which was a huge thing because I didn't get to a semi-final, but I was after hurling great stuff with the club and also great stuff with up to the league.
And so, does the club feed into it? It does.
I think it does, because as the journalist,
I'm not sure.
I think it does. The journalists pick it, you know, and next thing, like, when they go to, for example, right, lads, we'll go picking the full forward line here. Here's the nine nominees for the three positions. The next thing they're going to Damien Hayes. Next thing, for example, like in 2005, it was a couple of weeks previous that I won my very first All-Star. I was after scoring 2-6 from playing a county final against Loughrea. And if you're asking me, did that put something into the, we'll say, recognition of you? I think it did. That's my honest, you know, club is where it starts and where it finished. But I just hate the way people kind of knock, the, you know, anyone that has one. It is an incredible honour, and it's a lovely thing to say that you have won an All-Star, and it's a big thing for clubs as well.
Yeah, and like, I mean, so you won one in 2010 and you only got to a quarter final. You must have been doing some scoring, or how many games did you play?
We got beaten by Loch, by Tipperary in the quarter final, and Tip went on to win the All-Ireland. I remember I was marking Mickey Cal, cornerback, so I was for Tipperary, and I scored 1-3 from play. It's gas, Colm. I remember all these stats. That just shows you how much I was into it. Like, a lad asked me one day, do you remember every goal you scored? I can tell you about every goal and pint that I scored if you asked me about the match. There's no piece of play that I wouldn't be able to. Yeah, I remember I scored 1-3 that day, and I was hurling great stuff in 2010, and John McIntyre was the manager. We were after winning the league as well.
The league definitely feeds into it. Yeah, the league.
Without question, we won the league that year. We beat Cork. I marked Sean O'Gahalpine the same year in the final. I always remember Jordan O'Connan wrote a snippet in the Star, basically saying that Damien Hayes has fully retired Sean O'G in the league final. You know, but no, I always say just. To win an All-Star is very special. Not every player wins an All-Ireland medal. Example, Damien Hayes, Tony Brown, Ken McGrath. But like Tony Brown and Ken McGrath were always great examples for me to say, like, they were two legends in my eyes. Absolutely outstanding hurling men. Didn't win All-Ireland medals, but won All-Stars. Tony Brown, for example, won a Senior Hurler of the Year award. And sure, geez, they have to mean stuff to them, even though they wouldn't. You know, and the answer is they do. You know, and I think it's a huge, huge award. And I'd love a player to come out sometime that's after winning it in the next couple of years and go, what's this mean to you? And they're just basically saying, well, it means the world to me and my family and my club, because this is what it does mean. You know, and wouldn't you get great satisfaction of a lad saying that on television? It's as you opposed would. To just kind of knocking it.
Yeah. No, you definitely would. Come here. Did you mention a snippet from Gerard Loughnane? Did you keep snippets from newspaper? Do you have scrapbooks or the mother?
Mammy did. No.
Yeah, my mother did for a long time. I think she gave up on it then.
Mammy did. Mammy and Daddy would. You know, it's gas. Our house is no different, Colm. You'd play a league final or club All Ireland final, county final. The next day, the big thing was to win and get the paper. Read yeah. it, see what journalists said something about you, whatever, you know, and then you'd have the Connacht Tribune coming out in the tours, and, you know, they used to have a team in the Connacht Tribune called Sports Star of the Week, which I often won, and Mammy would cut them out, and she has them all in. She says that she's going to put them into a book sometime, but I've heard that now for the last 20 years, so I have, but yeah, we would click the snippets and if cut them out, and look, our house is no different. Our house is just a stone mad J house, and my even programs we used to get, and also just going back to the All-Stars, like Colm, like everyone knows that knows me knows that I lost my brother sighted, you know, in a car crash, right? He was extremely close to, we slept in the same room, everything. But if I was to tell you, Colm, I have 20 videos recorded of the Bank of Ireland All-Stars in the cassettes. Do you know the cassettes?
Yeah.
And they're still down in the far playroom that when myself and Keith used to record them, and we used to turn them on every now and again. You'd see Pete Finnerty, or you'd see Sylvie Nenan, or Conor Hayes, or Nick English collecting his All-Star award. And we recorded. So basically to say, like, did it mean much to you? You can only imagine what it meant to me, like.
That's a nice note to leave this section on, Damien. We'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about farming. Smaller Fish GEA is powered by Benetti Menswear, who supply a range of tailoring, groomswear, casual menswear, footwear and accessories. Okay, so the show is called Hurling and Farming with Damien. So I suppose, Damien, we'll have to start at the start and find out what farm you actually have, because we're very interested in seeing how this year goes along on the farm. What are we dealing with here?
Yeah, so I it's kind of an interesting one that you said you want to do. Hurling and farming. So look, we come from a farming background. We live in an area called Gortarumra. It's in the townland of Portumna, so it is, and it's 3.5 miles outside Portumna. And we were born and reared on a farm. So we were. So what does our farm consist of? It consists of sheep and cattle. So
right.
The enterprise that we'd run, I suppose, in the farming world is that we would have ewes dropping. We will lamb our ewes this year. We'll out our ram in November. Okay, so anyone that doesn't know, a ram is a male sheep that puts the sheep in lamb. So we'll have lambs in April. So we'll, and then we have suckler cows. So we'll have cows calving in April. And then we have beef cattle that we finish, which means we buy in cattle that we will feed on grass and on silage and on nuts. And we will feed them up to 30 months of age. So they would be sold from the ages of 24 months to 30 months of age to the factories.
Right. So
for meat.
Yeah, for meat. Yeah, for meat. So how many cattle, how many sheep do you have?
So in April, we will lamb down roughly around 250 ewes in the month of April, and we will lamb them outdoors. Some people would be lambing sheep at the moment, Colm, but they would be going for the Easter market, right? If you're a top farmer, a top class sheep farmer, you will be finishing your lambs on meal, along with being on the ewe, between 12 and 14 weeks. So that's where a farm is a business as well. So you would be having them finished. That would be the target. So that's where you'd be getting your leg of lamb, your lamb roast or your lamb chops, all that. But we lamb in April, so we do, which is for the late evening. So when I come home from work, I'll be able to drive the van up the field. The land is hard, and if ewe drops, I can throw into the back of the van with the two lambs or one lamb or three lambs and bring them down to the sheds and put them into a pin and give the ewe or lambs whatever it is required.
Right. So you're timing letting the ram out to do his business and have them ewing almost for the bright evening so you can help out. Sure, you obviously sell cars.
So that's what happens. So then myself and my dad and would do the farming. So Al, he's a mighty man, so he's right. So then during the day's work, Al could drive out in his van and he'll drive up the fields of Churchill in Gortermra, which is a little townland area where the Muldoons and the Hayes and the Cannons came from, right? And we will drive up, and basically, long story short, Colm, the most important thing when a ewe drops, right, the most important thing a lamb gets is a thing called colostrum, which is the first feed, and you can also make up colostrum that you can get from the vets. So we would love when a ewe drops, for example, at 12 o'clock in the day, we will feed the lamb, and then when I come home from work, if we feel the lamb is weak and the ewe is whatever, we would then put them into the van and bring them down to the sheds. If they're good and hardy, we will leave them out. Now, our only fear would be foxes like this, but if we were in any fear of that, we might bring them down and just leave the lambs and the ewes beside the home house and keep an eye on them.
Right, okay.
And then we would get up. Then when the ewes are dropping, we would go to bed around 12 o'clock. We would check them up to 12 o'clock, drive around the field in the vans because the land is hard with our headlamps on. And if we have to catch a ewe, I'm able to catch a ewe, no problem. In the field, I'll run after and catch her. And Al will be with me. And if we had to pull lambs, she was having difficulty lambing, we would. And then we would put them into the van. We often left a ewe and two lambs in the van. So you might say, what type of van is it? So it's just the size of a caddy. A caddy van? So
yeah.
And then we bring them down to sheds where we put them into a sheep pen where there's lights. And all that. And then what would happen is, Colin, we go to bed and we get up again around 6 o'clock. So some lads would be sleeping with them, but we wouldn't. So we go up at 6 o'clock and we drive around, and whatever the ewes have lambed, and we haven't lambed, they will lamb in due course.
And why are you feeding them? Is the mother not able to feed them?
No, you will, but you'd only feed them just to give them a hand if required. Only if required. Oh, geez, there'll be lots of ewes out there that wouldn't need a hand at all, but. You know, every one of them are different. You know, you could go up and a ewe could drop and have two lambs and she could have them fed herself, so you wouldn't need to go near them.
And how long do you have that lamb there then that's just been born and before you sell it off?
Yeah, the top farmers that'll be feeding them will say send them to the factory. His goal would be 12 to 15 weeks.
Right.
And that's where
would you be fattening them up then, or just leaving them out in the grass?
Your goal is to get the lamb in the region of 45 to 50 kilos, and the factories will pay out anything up to 22 to 24 kilos or 25 kilos dead weight.
Right.
But like sheep at the moment has been at an all time high. There's lads last year and even this year that have been getting up to 170 euros a lamb. Each, where more likely the average lamb would usually only make anything from, we'll say, a finished lamb 100 to 110 or 115 euros. But the last year, sheep have been unbelievable prices, roughly adding up to 170 euros.
Right, so there's good money in the lamb. And would you not have any kind of, you know, moral issue with the lamb that you've been feeding by hand, and some farmers be sleeping in the pen with it, and you're getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to help rear this for 12 to 15 weeks, and then you're selling it off to be killed?
No, the answer is I don't, just because that's like, what if you can look at it that way, you can look at it another way, but sure, like, we're all eating meat. Do you know what? And you're looking after.
Yeah, but not baby lambs, though.
No, this isn't a baby lamb. Sure, obviously the baby lamb, but once he gets to that age, he's fit for killing. But then there's other people that would hold on to their lambs, their yo lambs, and keep them for replacement mothers.
Right.
So you could have a lamb that born, just to give an example, this morning, right? And that lamb could be on your farm for 8 years, for 7 years.
Yeah, but that would be a very small percentage. Most of them would be.
They would, yeah.
Most
correct. Of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. My sister won't eat lamb because of that reason. I've not, to be honest, I might be asking the question here.
A lot of women don't eat lamb, and I have relations that are in the butcher trade, and they will tell you that a lot of women won't cook lamb because they don't like the smell of it, and it leaves a smell in the kitchen. In comparison to beef. And then you will get some people that will tell you that when they're eating lamb, they can get the smell of actual sheep off the lamb, which it never happened to me. But I was told before, a lot of women just don't like the smell of lamb and they don't like cooking it.
Yeah, maybe. It tastes delicious. That's the only problem I have. I don't really mind, like, you know, eating meat. I eat meat and all that. But and you know, people tell you not to eat meat. I don't really listen to that. But you're not the right one to be talking to conversations. I do see the people's argument when they say they don't eat lamb. You know, I don't agree with the lambs being killed, you know, that early.
Yeah, well, that's what happens, Colm. So there's lambs born around Christmas. Just to give you an example, there would have been lambs born around Christmas, and they will be sent to the slaughter, we'll say, to the factories, we'll say, entering from the end of March to the end of April. They will, like, the top sheep farmer, that will be his goal.
Right. So how many times can the top sheep farmer turn it around in a year then? How many times will he let the ram out?
There's a breed called a Dorset sheep. Right now, there isn't that many of them around, but they can breed twice a year.
Right.
But the majority of breeds that we have, we'll say that all the farmers have, the most popular breeds in Ireland is the Texel, the Suffolk, and the Charolais. Okay? They're basically once a year.
They're once a year. But like, when the lambs are taken off them, would they not come back into season quickly?
No, they won't. No, they won't. They won't come into season, no. So they're left in a paddock, kind of just left to graze to keep in good condition, and then you'd be dosing them and making sure they're in good shape and all that, because it's very important that they're in good, what they call condition score, we'll call it, for when they're being let out to the ram. Now, we breed a sheep ourselves. I'm a sheep called a Kerry Hill. Have you ever heard of it? They come with a sheep. I find this all hilarious now that we're doing this. Bananas. Kerry Hill sheep. So they're a speckled lamb. People think they come from Kerry, but they're not. They're a Welsh breed. And that's the sheep that the rams we run, because they're very easy lambing, Colm, for the month of April, because lambs will be getting bigger because the grass is getting more plentiful, right? And they have a smaller head, and they also breed lovely yo lambs. So that's just what we're into.
Right. And so when do you dunk them then? You see this thing where I've often seen it, and you put them in a pen and they go through and there's no way past other than jumping down into this water, and then they come out.
Yeah, that's called dipping.
Dipping, not dunking, right?
Okay, that's called dipping. So basically that's for the fly. So there's the green fly which produces maggots in the sheep. And that's a disgusting thing now. If you want, like, a sheep could die from that stuff. Like from getting maggots. So it's because it's so warm that the fly basically nests inside in the wool, produces maggots, and then the maggots basically will eat into a sheep. So when you dip or you put on this, what you call this pour on, it will keep the fly away, which is good for the sheep. So yeah, anyone that would have sheep would be doing this.
Right, right. And is there any other way of making money out of sheep? Do you shear them and sell their wool or anything like that?
No, but the wool, it wouldn't pay.
No.
To get anyone to shear sheep, it's roughly 250 AO, right? But you wouldn't get it back in the wool. Waste of time. The wool, it wouldn't pay the sheep shearer. Just the price of wool is absolutely shocking.
Right. And sure, how is the sheep shearer costing so much if there's like no value in it?
I'll be honest with you, and if there's any sheep shearers, listen to me. He's worth every penny of it. Like, it's an awful hard job, Colm. You need to see it. Like, a lad could have to shear 300 joes there in a row. And I've often done it. As in, when I say I've often done one or two, your back would be buckled.
Yeah, holding them in.
You're holding them down with your knees. Oh, I'm telling you, that's not a simple job at all. So it's not. And it's a specialist job. So it is. And the other thing, Colm, anyone that has sheep shears, they often have problems with their muscles afterwards because they're holding a sheep shear and yoke that's vibrating through your body for hours and hours.
And how many would the good lads go through in a day then?
Oh, geez. So, like, there's some lads that could shear a yoke here in a minute and a half. So,
yeah, I've seen clips of them. There's competitions and all with that.
I'd say a good sheep shearer. I'd say if he went through 250 a day, he's the right one.
Jesus, but that's like sprints. Your first 50 meter sprint, you might go do well, but by the time you got to number 200, you might not be at your minute and a half.
Yeah. So we'd often have lads coming down, there'd be lads there from Kerry that would come down and basically just shear sheep all around our area, and they'd rent a spot for maybe 4 weeks and then go back to Kerry again. It would make it worth their while. Like, that's their summer. Like,
well, you're making some money if you're 250 euros and you're going through 200 a day. Yeah. Holy mother of God.
You know.
And you don't need any equipment. You just need the bloody shearers.
You need a generator, and you need to have a little setup with a trailer, and then you need to have all the, what they call the sheep shearing pins, and then you have to have... there's a bit of cost to it as well, but it's just very, very hard work, Colm.
Yeah, geez, if this subscriber model doesn't work out for me in February, I think I have a new trade. Absolutely. I might go into shearing sheep.
And I tell you, you'll get lots of phone. You'll get lots of phone calls, lads wondering how you do it, and they'll want them done yesterday.
And have the perfect name for it as well, Woolly's sheep shearing.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that might catch up. We'll leave it there, Damien, because we're out of time, and we'll talk about the cattle next week, and maybe some accidents on the farm. And if there's plenty of things I want to talk to you about. One other thing is, though, because you said to me before that farmers, you know, when the hurlers, the farmers and. You know, I think that's what you said to me before, that like farming makes you very, very hardy. I'm thinking of Noel Hickey and these boys.
It's a different strength, Colm, to gym strength. And also, you know, anyone that I know that was farming, they've also built up a reserve in what you call fitness. Because you might say to yourself, what are you on about, Jamie? Like, anyone that's farming is running after cattle, running after sheep, running up hills, running down hills. Like, you know, this is what you're... And then, like, for example, if you're a sheep farming... Like, if a ewe has to be caught, like, you have to catch him. Like, or if a ewe has to be put into a pin, you have to catch him, and you'll have a little bit of a wrestle at times with it. Like, and you're building up a different center core. I'm telling you, if it does, like, I'll give you an example. One lad that always came across to me was a fierce, hardy ewe, was Noel Hickey from Kilkenny. Sure, he was a farmer. John Power from Kilkenny. He, you know, from center forward, he was a farmer. Like, and anyone that just... farms, it's a different strength, and there's a reserve there, and there's a every farmer will tell you he'll never give in. It's nearly a psychology thing that, like, a farmer won't give in. If he's a job to do, he'll get it done.
A thickness, probably called.
You know, but but farming strength is a completely different strength to gym strength. I put any of these lads that are big into the gyms, hand them a fork there and tell them to clean out a shed, or go fork and silage, or go catch a yo and, we'll say, go down the line with her, you know, as in holding onto her and put her into a trailer 100 yards away. They'll know all about it.
Yeah, you'd know by shaking their hand nearly on the field that they're... You'd nearly tell a working farmer or a working man anyways.
You'd have the welts on your on your hands, you know, but... Yeah, it's just a different strength, and if there's anyone that's listening to me, they'll know what I'm on about. It's just a different. You're a hardier whore. That's what you are.
I think you are. Well, listen, we've learned a lot about lambs and ewes today, and you know how it all works. We can stay tuned for Hurling and Farming, the farming section next week. And if you have any questions for Damien, I'm more than happy to put it for them. But we're going to leave it there for today. That's it. So Smaller Fish, as you all know by now, is powered by Benetti Menswear. It's an Irish brand who are one of Ireland's leading menswear suppliers. Good luck.
Smaller Fish Hauling Show, huh? I wouldn't listen to that gutless shower if you paid. That's wrong.
These bluffers know as much about top-level hurling as I do about the sleeping habits of the Ayatilla.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are, and we're trying hard to make it through. But it's harder to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.